Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Monday, June the 9th, 2003. At this time, I'm going to open an informational public hearing without a quorum present for the purpose of consideration of House Bill 3522.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 3522 directs the Department of Transportation to adopt rules covering the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Fund, and we require folks that receive those monies to distribute those funds consistent with the rules adopted by the department.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, it's Representative Johnson et al. May I, with your indulgence, ask the department to join me?
Certainly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 31. I'm sorry that Senator Dukes isn't here this morning because she has a very keen knowledge of the problem that this bill attempts to address. In many instances, the Department of Transportation passes money through for the Elderly and Disabled Special Transportation Funds, passes through to county commissions, and county commissions then in turn contract with private not-for-profits. In 90% of the cases, that arrangement works very well, and we don't want to do anything with this rulemaking that disrupts that very orderly flow. But in those instances, which the minority of instances, wherein there are troubles, we would like to give the department with this legislation a little extra boost in taking back unspent funds. This situation became painfully clear in Columbia County, where senior transportation services were administered by a not-for-profit that has basically imploded. They will be the first AAA decertified by the Department of Human Services. ODOT is in the process of canceling their contracts, and as the contracts were being canceled, they're left with an excess of $100,000 that they are now spending with no oversight at all. And what House Bill 3522 attempts to do is to give ODOT the ability to take back money that is not being appropriately spent. I visited a little bit with the counties, and they were quite concerned that somehow this rulemaking would not include them. I reassured their representatives that it is the department's in their department's best interest and also their desire to have all the affected parties at the table, and that really what we're trying to do is to just put a little more teeth in ODOT's ability to take back money in instances, rare instances, where the money's not being properly applied.
Good morning, Chair George, committee members. Martin Loring, Administrator of the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. Representative Johnson is exactly correct. The Special Transportation Fund, administering state funds to provide transportation services for the elderly and disabled, works very well. We can quibble on percentages. Representative Johnson talked about 90. Maybe it's even higher.
99.
Yeah, almost all the time it works right. But what we discovered is in the very rare instances where it doesn't, there is a mismatch between the responsibility that we think the legislature gave us to be good stewards of these public funds and the authority to actually act on that responsibility. Under current law, we have the authority to write rules for the administration of these funds, but not write rules affecting the implementation, to set standards, to require, in fact, that the governing bodies and the transportation providers that use these funds actually follow legislative intent and take action where there's a discrepancy. We initially tried to do this. We sought advice of counsel and were advised by the Department of Justice that we didn't have the authority to follow through and take action in the exceedingly rare cases of wrongdoing. We think that was an oversight, and Representative Johnson proposed that presumed oversight be corrected to this language that tells us to do the other half, write some rules relating to the implementation of the Special Transportation Fund. And she's again correct with respect to how we would proceed. We would form an advisory committee, broadly based, involving all affected parties to help us. The essence of this program is local control, local decisions on where these, on what the priority needs are of the elderly and disabled, and how those needs would be best met. We still believe in local control, but believe that we need the authority to make things right in those exceedingly rare cases where they go wrong. Thank you.
Martin, do all of the dollars have to pass through a local county commissioners?
Chair George, committee members, as you recall, we talked about this in the hearings on the budget. Mm-hmm. The answer is no. They pass through one of three sets of entities currently. In 28 counties, they pass through the Board of County Commissioners. In the other eight counties, they pass through five districts, special purpose districts of one kind or another. One kind are mass transit districts, like TriMet, Lane Transit District, Salem Area Mass Transit District, and the other kind of special district is transportation districts, Rogue Valley Transportation District, Tillamook County Transportation District, Hood River County, those entities. The reason for the difference between 5 and 8 is that, as you probably know, TriMet involves three counties, Salem involves two.
Right.
So in all cases, they go through a board of elected officials at the local level. In most of the cases, Chair George, you're exactly right, it's county commissioners, but in eight counties, it's a board of a district.
And either the county commissioners or the mass transit districts or transportation districts don't have the authority to regulate that dollar, those dollars, after they've been distributed to recover, or?
Chair George, committee members, yes, they do. But what we found that in county government in Oregon is really strapped financially. They don't have a lot of staff. And what we find is even well-meaning commissioners have a difficult time taking action in rare cases. Our counsel is here if you wanted to ask. I believe the county commissioners do have the authority. This would give us the ability to help support and nudge them where, given authority, they still fail to act.
You just mentioned staffing, and that's when I was looking at the bill. I was thinking about a couple of times when I've had bills that were somewhat similar to this, to find you to get a fiscal report on them of $150,000 or more dollars. And what do you think this is going to cost for us to administer? Because you are talking about taking on additional rulemaking, regulatory authority, and I'm just curious what we're talking about in cost here to the department.
Chair George, committee members, The fiscal on this is limited to the cost to write a set of administrative rules. So we're talking, I don't know, $10,000, $15,000. I don't have the fiscal directly in front of me, but not very much money. In terms of administering it, you have already given us staffing and budgetary authority to administer the funds and carrying that responsibility from just doling out the money to making sure it's well spent is certainly will cost us a little bit more, but I believe that we can do it within the proposed level of staffing. No, we're not asking for an increase, nor do we believe one's warranted, because the local governments do such a good job in the vast majority of circumstances.
Well, that's what worries me is, you know, somebody's going to be coming back saying, oh, gee, you gave us this new authority and now we need more staff. I want assurance from you that that's not going to happen, that you're envisioning this as under a very, very limited set of circumstances that you would be required to intervene. But hopefully with rules, then you'll have your local partners who are stepping up to the plate and making sure that it is properly administered. Is that correct?
Chair George, yes, with an appropriate caveat. I remember someone once used the phrase, it wouldn't be prudent. It probably wouldn't be prudent for me to promise to never, ever, ever ask for any staff increases, but it is not my plan to do that, and you certainly have the authority to use that magic two-letter no word if at some future date we deem it advisable to ask for staffing and you don't think we've made the case.
And, Mr. Chair, I would add that I never contemplated when we drafted this legislation that it would have anything more than a negligible fiscal. In consultation with the department, the idea was to just be a backstop against these emergency situations that produce the kind of headlines that we had in our local paper, Colco, which is Columbia County Transportation, cancels rides, employees left hanging, COCO future is uncertain. We simply are sitting on the sidelines now watching our transportation system, our senior and disabled, and to the degree that they offer public transportation, crumble while the board that's still in place is squandering in excess of $100,000. And this would these rules, with I absolutely assure you, I have no interest in making this some great giant bureaucracy that will be mucking with local government. This would just offer a backstop to help reinforce local government decisions in these rare, rare instances where the providers fail to act. And this would give tools for ODOT to be able to take back the money that in Columbia County is now out on the street. And instead of prudently making arrangements for the successor transportation agency, whoever that may be, to use what remaining funds there are, the funds are being dissipated with no ability to get them back at this point. So this bill fixes a very narrow problem, and Senator Dukes is all too painfully aware of the headlines. And Senator Dukes and I worked with for 2 years with the private not-for-profit that administers these funds, trying to rehab a board that was unable to behave like a board. And now that they finally have collapsed, have been cut off by ODOT, decertified, or in the process of decertification by Department of Human Services, 3522 attempts to give ODOT enough teeth to just grab back the money in these rare failed instances.
Let me do this. We have a quorum present, so I'm going to reopen that as a full public hearing on House Bill 3522. Also, we have the sign-up sheet up here. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify if we go further? Okay. Are there any questions for Representative Johnson or for Martin relative to House Bill 3522? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone prepared to work open as a work session? We'll do that. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3522, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3522.
Mr. Chair, I'm catching up here. Is there any amendments, or do we just move the bill?
There are no amendments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3522 to full committee with a due passage recommendation.
Okay. Any further discussion about it? Yes, Representative.
Well, just very quick couple comments. The system that we have in place with the nonprofits, I think, does work very well. But certainly in Portland and in my district, we've seen some nonprofits that become dysfunctional. It's incredibly painful to the community when that happens, and I really sympathize to Columbia County for having to go through this type of a problem. I had one similar circumstance happened in North Portland 20 years ago, though. It was just very difficult to sort out all the details of it after you have a collapse like that. And then we've had several others in the Portland area. Well-meaning, good-spirited volunteers that have put a lot of energy in, and because of either managing problems, financial difficulties, whatever, when they implode, they implode. And if this puts one more tool in terms of being able to sort out these difficult situations and get the dollars back to the people that need the service, then it's a real easy thing for me to support.
Senator Dukes.
Mr. Chair, one of the reasons I think this will be particularly helpful is that, personally, I'm not very comfortable with giving public money to private nonprofit organizations. And the reason I'm not is that they are not subject to public meeting laws. Their records are not subject and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you can make the case that public money is subject to public oversight, but sometimes even that, if they don't want to hear it, is difficult to make. And so it's often difficult to get the information that you need when you suspect there may be some problem. And we found that in this case is that it became incredibly difficult to get the information they needed. Of course, it wasn't all in the shoebox either. I mean, not literally. I'm sorry. It's been an interesting 2 years. But I think that this bill will help us get at that. It's not that the private nonprofits don't do a great job. In the vast majority of the cases, they certainly do. But it's interesting that they are not subject to all of the things that we take for granted, like public meetings law, and so they can meet behind closed doors and decide how they're going to spend their public money.
Okay, any further discussion on House Bill 3522 under work session? Do we have any objections to moving it to the monthly motion? We have is to the full way through with a due pass recommendation. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Without objection? So, Senator Dukes.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, okay. All right, yeah, you're Is that okay, Bessie?
I'd be happy to.
Representative Johnson will be the carrier. All right, thanks. Brilliant. Okay, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3522, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2783A.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2783A would require the Department of Transportation to collect Social Security numbers on applications for driver licenses and permits. Would prohibit the department from disclosing that information to anyone other than another governmental agency for their official functions, would allow the department to establish fees to reimburse them for distributing that list to another government agency if they requested it, and would punish the unlawful acquisition and use of Social Security numbers by a Class A misdemeanor. There is a set of -A3 amendments that I believe most of the parties involved, if not all of the parties involved, are in agreement with. Chair Williams from House Judiciary is comfortable with this committee taking action on these sets of amendments, and the co-chairs have approved this set of amendments that would allow an applicant to sign a written or sign a statement indicating that they have never been issued a Social Security number in those rare instances. And if an individual issued that statement and knowing it was false, that was also be subject to a Class A misdemeanor. Mr. Chair and members, this legislation, as I understand it, is being brought forward to bring us into compliance with a federal requirement for child and spousal support enforcement and to receive the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families grant. Without this legislation, we could potentially lose $85 million in federal funds for the child support enforcement and potentially be subject to penalties from $5 to $11 million for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And we do have members from Department of Justice and Transportation here to speak to the specifics if they would like.
Okay, let's invite them up.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice, here today in support of 2783A. Ms. Brown has given you a very accurate description of what is before you today. You have my written testimony, I think, in your files in front of you, so I will just very briefly give you the background on this bill. In 1997, in the legislative session, the Department of Justice brought forward the child support provisions of welfare reform. That was a very large bill that the Assembly passed that year, 200 and some pages of details. One of the things in that bill was putting into place this federal mandate for the child support program, the requirement for licensing agencies to gather Social Security numbers on applications. Oregon already had a successful license suspension process for child support in place at that time. We were one of the progressive states already using that tool, but it added this technical detail. In the drafting of that large bill and all of the amendments and work groups that ensued, we purely missed the word drivers. So we picked up commercial licenses, but not the regular driver's licenses. The reason we haven't brought this before you in an earlier session is, quite honestly, we were still working out some of the details with the other licensing agencies and wanted to get all of those things taken care of before we came back with this topic. So that's why you have this before you today. Another piece, briefly, is the use of the Social Security number by the Child Support Program is as a secondary identifier. The Child Support Program already gathers Social Security numbers as one of a series of elements and pieces of information that are used in domestic relations law. So what would occur here is if we were going forward with a license suspension on a driver's license and we had someone with a common name and a similar date of birth, we might want to look one step further at the identifier of Social Security number to make sure we're really suspending the correct person's license and not inadvertently going after someone who, in fact, does not owe support. So that's a real brief summary of what you have here today. There's more information in my written testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions. It is true, as one final note, that the A3s are the final, what I'm calling, compromise amendments. When we were before House Judiciary, we were still working out some of the details of those amendments, and Chair Williams said, let's keep this bill moving forward since it's so crucial to the funding of the program and work out those final amendments in a later committee. So that's why they're here before you today.
Chair, you expanded the list of licenses. You talked about that. Do you have specifics at which ones you're now expanding to?
Chair George, Representative Krieger, the terminology in the statute is that all professional, occupational, recreational, and including now driver's licenses. So basically any license or permit that it is issued by an agency falls under the existing statute. The only piece missing was the driver's licenses.
This includes any license you might have relating to your ability to earn a living?
Chair George and Representative Krieger, that is correct. If your license to earn a living falls under the definition of professional occupational, that is already in the statute, has been in place since 1997 as a possible enforcement tool.
Follow up? And then they're subject to losing their income that could be used for paying the child support. How does that play out? How do they make a living if they don't have a license to do the child support that they're now not playing? It's like a hoop. How do you get off of it?
Correct. Chair George, Representative Krieger, you have asked the crucial question that we've had much testimony, including constituency testimony in the past hearings. It is not the intent of the child support program to suspend licenses. It is our intent that for those customers who are unwilling to pay and are basically playing games with the system and other methods of enforcement are not working, to use this as a tool to get them to come into compliance, enter into a payment agreement, and stay in compliance in order to keep their license. It is obviously not a good tool if we have to take a license away and someone cannot get to work or cannot do their profession. On the very back of my testimony, you'll see some of the statistics. At the beginning of that chart, you can see how many initial notices go out to people that qualify for this enforcement remedy, and then you can also see the number of payment agreements and hardship agreements we enter into. Our preference would be to enter into an agreement and not take the license. Sometimes, as you can see, we actually do have to take the license to really get their attention, and then as soon as they come back and sign a payment agreement, we would release the suspension.
Senator Dukes?
I think we have to do this. I think we stand to lose a whole lot of federal money if we don't do this. But this is stupid. I'm sorry. I know that it's not your fault. But we're talking about people who have not felt an obligation to meet their legal obligations. And we know that we have hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of people driving without driver's licenses. I sort of suspect that these folks, it's not going to mean a lot to them if we threaten to take their driver's license. It'll just make them angrier and less compliant. So if we do this, I think it's because we stand to lose a whole lot of federal money if we don't do it, but not because it makes any sense or it's going to get anybody to pay their child support.
Senator Carter, then we'll go to Senator Representative Krieger.
The thing about me is I don't care about the federal money. I don't care about any of it. What I do care about is the invasion of our privacy on everything that you can just about think of. Tell me why I'm wrong in order to get my yes vote.
Chair George, Senator Carter, it is correct that Oregon laws already require customers, as we call them, persons who are going in for a divorce or any family issue, to give certain statistical information to the child support program, name, address, employer, date of birth, and, yes, your Social Security number. You are not wrong. We do gather all that information because the laws tell us we must do so. It would be my hope, and it is certainly the intent of the program, that we use those solely for the intent and purposes of that law and nothing further. But it is a piece of information that must be released. The A3 amendments do allow persons who do not have Social Security numbers to continue forth in the application process, but that does not apply to persons who really do have a Social Security number. They must provide it.
Follow up.
Tell me how you protect the privacy of the number.
Chair George, Senator Carter, the statistical information in child support records is held highly confidential. We have currently a bill being reviewed, which is amending ORS 25260. Those are the child support confidentiality laws. And House Bill 2113 this session is looking to tighten that down even further. Basically, a short summary of our confidentiality laws would say this: no one's entitled to information from child support records unless they're a party to the case, generally mom and dad. Further, they're not entitled to each other's information unless the law requires that it be used in a particular legal action. Currently, the law does require us to release, or I shouldn't say release, to file that information in circuit court when we're doing a filing of an order. However, there is a provision called, two provisions actually in the law, address of record and claim of risk. And if either mom or dad says there's good reason why you should not release the information to the other party, they're able to provide an alternative, and we do not release that information in that case. So we do our best to keep it intently for the purposes of our file and not to be released to any other persons.
Follow up.
What's the measure you take in terms of employees getting information out to someone else?
Chair George, Senator Carter, if you're speaking about releasing information out from one of our employees, we have a very strict policy in place regarding the confidentiality of child support records for our employees, and in fact, we also have a piece called conflict of interest. Many of our employees know someone who has a case in the system. That policy does allow for discipline up to termination if we find that someone has released information from our files, or if we find that a partner agency has accessed and released information from our files.
Kelly, what are the measures that you've taken since the identity theft incidents that happened with the Department of Motor Vehicle and in terms of securing information?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I want to touch on a couple things, Senator Carter, in your question. First, personal information is protected under the Federal Driver Privacy Protection Act, something you all put into place here in Oregon back in the 97 session. And personal information is things like your name, your address, your date of birth, your Social Security number, phone number, although I want you to know we don't have your phone number, but that's one of the things listed under the federal law. And ever since the 97 session when that happened, and I think you probably remember a gentleman who put a bunch of records out on the Internet and stuff. Well, we don't release personal information out to general public anymore. You can get your own record, but if you went up to get my record, you could get the contents of my driving record, what convictions or actions I may have, but you will not get my personal information. You can no longer come into a DMV office and say, you know, I saw a cute blonde driving a Camaro with such and such license plate. I'd like to know who that was. We won't tell you. We no longer release that information. And so what we've done is we've had to follow the Driver Privacy Protection Act. This bill, the language is in here about us not releasing it and having rules and only giving it to governmental agency, is part of that, making sure we are still in compliance with that. So that we've been collecting Social Security numbers for commercial driver licenses as part of the Federal Commercial Act for driver licenses since 1989. Those have never been released. Even before the 97 Driver Privacy Protection Act, we did not release Social Security number. We did not release mother's maiden name and place of birth that we use on our driving records to know who we've got in front of us. Those are some of the things we've done to try to get at the identity theft. We are also, and so this Social Security number collection would fall under just like we've done with commercials. It would be part of the record, but not released. It may be released to a government agency for their governmental function if required by law. And what we've done to help on the identity theft, we have a new driver's license coming out with enhanced security features. It will be almost impossible to get the laminate off. You won't be able to get back on cleanly anymore. That's one of the things people do is they heat them to get the laminate off. It's their picture, it's their own license actually, but then they put somebody else's name on it and seal it back up and try to go around pretending they're Kelly Taylor or whoever. the license we've put in, that we're putting into place this fall, has a number of security features in that I will not mention on record, because we want to make sure they stay, you know, security measures. but I will tell you that it's much harder to tamper with this and have it go undetected, and that's coming out this fall, and that's one of the things we're doing to try to help with that.
Representative Krieger.
Kelly, it was the Social Security number that gets us back into compliance. It wasn't expanding the type of things that we suspend.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, with this bill, the thing that is helping keep the child support program in compliance is simply noting that on regular driver's license applications and regular permits, we will be collecting the Social Security number. We already collect it for commercial driver license and have since 1989, way prior to even the Child Welfare Reform Act. So, yeah, what we're doing in this bill is simply collecting it.
Follow up,
kind of going outside of the prerogative where we are, but what triggers the suspension of the license? At what point, how far does someone have to be behind? How many times have they been contacted? That type of a process, because I know several that have been ongoing forever.
Chair George, Representative Krieger, let me clarify before I answer your question, because maybe I was not clear in my earlier testimony. We are not expanding the law to include driver's licenses. The law already includes driver's licenses, and we have a successful program in place. We're adding that piece of secondary identification. In response to your question, the current statute and rulemaking behind it says that a person has to be 3 months in arrears or $2,500 before this tool would be an option for us to use. And even then, it is still a discretionary tool based on the other remedies that we might have available.
Senator Dukes.
There used to be, with the feds, a provision. They would tell us to do things, and we either did them, or they had this little provision that said we could sort of pass a law saying this is why we don't want to do it. So I remember doing that once, and we got around the loss of a fee by doing that. I don't suppose that would work there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, it depends on how the federal rule, when it's first implemented, the federal law that's telling you to do something, whether or not they give you that out. The one I think you're referring to is the federal drug-related suspensions. And Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, I help put the letter together every year that the governor signs to say, guess what, we still don't want to comply. And it had to do with certain mandated suspensions involving drug-related activities, which you have some suspensions on the books about drug-related activities that could affect a driver's license. Don't get me wrong. This took it even further. And had you, if you didn't have a license, you had to, we had to wait around until Kelly tried to apply for a license and then say, aha, now you can't have it, and things like that. It set up quite an administrative setup going on. And that particular law gave states an out. And you all chose to enact that out. And so each year we do file a letter that says we have complied by passing this other provision, and so we're still in compliance. Okay. This one doesn't have that.
No questions. Any further questions? Yes, Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just sort of explain, I'll just briefly outline how we think this will play out in the field offices. We will add it to the applications. In talking with the other states, it looks like about half the time people just willingly give you the Social Security number, and about half the time they want to have a little discussion with you about it. In our fiscal analysis, we've determined that, you know, a 40-second conversation, which is not much, but a 40-second conversation with about half the folks that we're going to be dealing this with equals about 3 FTE out in our field offices. That is the bulk of the fiscal that you see in front of you. It's very, very small amount to change the driver license system to collect Social Security number on the rest of the applications, the ones we don't already. Most of the fiscal you see is the 3 FTE. And with the provision, the A3 amendments, that will allow us, if someone does not have a Social Security number, because you see, if you refuse to give us a Social Security number, you will not get a driver's license. This actually makes it one of the requirements for getting a driver's license to comply. But if you don't have one, how would you comply? And so you could sign the statement. And then we're not having to send somebody away to go get it notarized and come back and forth. It'll help us streamline it and keep it moving along. And I want to say, we are not going to be verifying Social Security numbers. We are not going to be hooked up electronically, checking to see whether Kelly's lied or not. We're going to take the number. We're going to process the application. So I just want you to know how it will all play out.
We need to watch this person named Kelly. I mean, we're getting up a lot in here. DMV may establish a fee for reimbursement of the cost providing this service.
Mr. Chair, you and I have talked records in the past. The records are built with highway fund dollars, and therefore we cannot give records away. That's why in statute we collect fees to cover the costs. And so we cannot, collecting Social Security numbers, we're using highway fund dollars, we can't just give it away. We would collect the costs.
Well, and that was my question, is why can't we get the money that's going to be collected, all these hundreds, tens of millions of dollars, to cover the costs of administering this new additional requirement? In other words, feds are requiring it, federal dollars are coming in, why can't they pay for the function?
Well, Mr. Chair, it is the collection of the Social Security number and everything can be paid for with highway fund dollars. And the federal dollars that are coming in are specifically targeted to do a child support program,
right.
The enforcement.
Right. But indirectly, this is benefiting them, because if, in fact, we didn't do it, they might be in jeopardy. But you feel this appropriate for us to collect it at that?
Mr. Chair, the way the bill is drafted, and when I've talked with the Attorney General's office, and I do have somebody here from the AG's office, in case we got into anything I couldn't answer about it, it is an appropriate use of highway fund dollars, since it is being made part of the licensing requirements.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many field offices do we have?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, we have 64. They're not all full service. There are some small offices and things that do limited service within that 64.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, yes.
The increase of three positions, or I guess it doesn't start out with three, it escapes me a little bit how we apply that to so many field offices.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, what it is it's, you know how many transactions you're going to do and you know how long it's going to take you to do the transactions, so it's just a mathematical problem. If we were to get the positions, the DMV budget is scheduled to cut some positions, and then there'll be some positions that may be restored based on legislation. We would place those positions in the heavier populated area where you're going to get the bulk of those transactions. I mean, that's what you try to do. You try to spread them around. You're right. You don't take a little bit and try to put them in 64, but you do have heavier populated areas that you could place those positions in where you're going to get the bulk of those transactions.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, typically the approach that Legislative Fiscal has taken in cooperation with ODOT is that the fiscal is written just as Kelly has indicated. It's incremental. But what we generally do is say we're not going to allocate those positions at this time. There's several bills that pass each session that affect the computer programming out of the DMV, potentially staffing in the field offices. And unless there's an obvious and very significant, not just three positions, increase, we generally say, let's go away, figure out your implementation plan, figure out what you need to do for programming, figure out how many staff cumulatively, and then come back to the emergency board during the interim if you can document that a particular field office's performance measures are completely offline or there's an obvious demonstrated need, rather than 64 field offices absorbing three FTE. I mean, you're correct, and how would you allocate those? So we generally take a more wait-and-see approach on these types of small incremental bills.
Mr. Chairman, is that prescriptive in this bill, that process that you just referenced?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, no, it's not prescriptive. This bill does not make or increase an expenditure limitation. So there are no dollars actually being allocated in this bill. There is a fiscal attached, but there is no limitation attached to the bill. The budget analyst in our office is aware of the bill. The agency also tracks and accumulates the bills at the end. So it's not without notice, but we aren't making any specific allocation with the passage of this bill today.
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
64 offices. How many total employees work within those divisions in those offices?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I'm going to guess maybe 300. I have no idea, to be honest. I'm going to say maybe 300 across.
I think
it.
If everybody walked to and from the counter faster, you wouldn't need the three positions. I can't.
Can you put that in law?
I don't know. I know when I had more to do and I said, I just hustled and got it done.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, not all the positions are dedicated to working counter. Some are out on the drive lines.
Yeah.
So they're not all there at the counter.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair George. I apologize if I missed something. This 2783, as part of this package, does create 2.25 FTE.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, we, with the passage of this bill, we are not establishing any positions. The fiscal has indicated that this, there could be approximately that equivalent of additional work generated, but it is not increasing their limitation. That is a decision that you can make either when you're discussing the agency's budget as a whole to say, how does the DMV look in as far as performance measures? Do they need additional resources in the field offices? Or the agency can come back later if they have a demonstrated need in a particular field office.
Follow-up, Chair George. I'm prepared to support House Bill 2783 because of the concept and what goes in behind it. However, I'm not prepared during the ODOT's budget to support 2.25 FTE, and I would hope that as we go through those budget discussions further that the 2.25 could be brought up for consideration by this committee. I'm of the opinion $246,000, you could cut that in half, have some customer service training, and get the job done. But I am prepared to support the bill.
Senator Wiggins.
I really have an interest in Delano because even though I don't like the bill, I know we're stuck with it. And I'm willing to support it, but only if we give them the FTE. I'm nervous, and I've been here and gone through the process that the staff outlines, and I've never had a problem with it until this session. And the reason I have a problem with this session is that there are people in the building who have given us an arbitrary number of FTE or positions, depending upon which day of the week it is, that we're supposed to be cutting out of ODOT's budget. And it has nothing to do with service. It has to do with a whole lot of other political gamesmanship that's going on. And so I am very nervous that if that sort of going out to get them lapses over into the interim, into the emergency board, that we will have difficulty getting these positions. And you know exactly what happens. I'm sorry, Representative Krieger, but we can't get those people in the wheelchairs up to the counter any faster sometimes. So, or the seniors. So that we, our constituents end up waiting in line longer. This is the most vulnerable piece in terms of public perception of ODOT is DMV. And I can remember when we promised 20-minute wait lines, and I can remember when we promised 15-minute wait lines. I don't know what the wait lines are today, but every time they get longer, we get phone calls. And so if what we're talking about is putting together a program that is going to cause longer wait lines in Portland this summer when it looks like it's going to be pretty darn warm, I may not be a Portland legislator, but somebody's going to hear about it. And I just think it would be dumb not to make sure that those positions are going to go. If we want to have that other political fight over the bigger FTE issue in the budget, then we will do that. But I think doing anything to jeopardize wait lines at a DMV is just dumb.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Chair George. I guess I'd be willing to support the positions if they were placed in LeGrand. Other than that, I'm not willing to do it.
Do
we
have to have all three?
We'll take one.
Oh, just one.
I'm actually going to place the instructions.
Okay. Representative Smith?
That's it.
Okay, that's it. Senator Carter.
I think what you're saying is that when you look at the workload, it's going to take approximately 18.75 from like FTE. But it does not necessarily mean that we are implementing 2.25 FTE. It also does not mean that they know where they're going to put them at this point, but they're going to put them in the most populated area where you won't have to have the lines within longer. I don't know whether you guys know living in a place like Portland. I got a car, and I was in line 45 minutes on one occasion. They really were trying very hard to help me. And it's not just because the lines are that long. It was due to my transferring her car from California to Oregon. And in order for them to get their information correct, that we had demanded that they get, colleagues, I have to tell you, Greg, please hear me, living in Portland. Let me tell you that some of the information that these people need is taken up by those of us who make their lives harder because we don't have all the things that they request. And sometimes not even having all that they request, we have to go back two and three times because we refuse to give it to them sometimes. It's the public who is being bad. The employees, as I've seen in North Portland, have done a good job of it. I just didn't have everything I needed when I went back for my car. And I had to help get these guys to help me to process it through. And I'm saying I either forgot a Social Security number, I forgot a VIN number, forgot something else. And it's the public that's causing these people headaches to get the job done. That's all I'm saying. And since they're not asking us to implement 2.75 or 3 positions, I think before they look at it in the scheme of things, even though, like I said, I have the problem with the privacy stuff, but I'm willing to do it since the federal government is mandating it to you. And so I'm prepared to say yes to that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, something must be escaping me here. We're going to be entering Social Security numbers on into a database. We're going to be including it on some forms, I assume. Where is the need for 3 FTEs? It escapes me just from a practical standpoint. I'm at a loss to understand why existing funds can't be redirected to assume this additional responsibility and get on with it. And exclude from this any reference to an FTE, and if there is a requirement for FTEs, come to the emergency board and get approval based on demonstrated need. So that something's escaping me here, I suspect, in this whole thing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, let me try to explain. When we put a fiscal together, what we're trying to do for you is to tell you that this is the workload associated with this bill. Whether or not you choose to fund it, we still tell you what it equals. These transactions that this hits, driver licenses, originals, renewals, permits, duplicates, equal over $1 million in a biennium. And when half of those people, and we base this on other experience from other states, Washington, for example, they've told us about half the people will give it to you without a problem, so it goes pretty quick. But about 50% of those people want to stop and ask you, why do you need it, what's this about, what are you going to do with it, and you have a conversation with them. We've calculated that if 50% of our transactions that we know we're going to have want to have a conversation with us, and that conversation is about 40 seconds long, that times all of those transactions divided by the hours available for a person to work equals about 3 FTE. So it's not, I'm just trying to give it to you for information. Whether or not you fund it is up to you guys. I'm just letting you know that, and I do that on all bills. I'll say it's either little or big. And I tell you how we got there and what we based it on. And I'm just telling you that putting it on the application, some people are going to give it to you. There won't be any conversation. But the 50% or so times 40 seconds, when you times it all out, equals about 3 FTE worth of effort. And we can use highway fund dollars to pay for it. That was the other piece of information I was trying to give you. So that's how it works out. And that's just what we do with fiscals. We just try to tell you this bill, this is what it means. Either it'll go down or it'll go up. And this is how we got there. So that's all I was trying to tell you.
Senator Morris, you already know that Senator Carter and I are going to probably ask, well, why do you need this information? It was that libertarian blood that flows in us.
And what are you going to do with it? Who's going to have access to it?
It's secure.
Yeah. How do I know? Yeah.
Can I sue somebody if, in fact, this is
good?
You
got that right.
What if I don't give it to you, then what?
Oh, man, you took the fun away from the next one. Any further questions for these two? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Brad Swain. Oh, I need the little feelings out of this.
Here, George. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. And I wanted to make you aware of an interesting controversy that has sprung out of this bill between the courts and DMV. If you will look on page 2 of the bill, and this is language that Senator George read earlier, the department may establish fees reasonably calculated to reimburse the department the actual cost of making an individual Social Security number available to the government agency as required by subsection 3 of this section. This spring, the State Court Administrator's Office has been considering requesting Social Security numbers for purposes of jury list duplicate elimination. When we get source lists, we get them from DMV, we get them from the Secretary of State's office, we can get them from other places, and one of the things that we try and do is eliminate duplicates so people's names don't appear on jury lists twice. So when this bill was in the House Judiciary Committee, I went there to make a record that we didn't believe this language that was in this bill impliedly repealed ORS 10.215, which requires DMV to give us jury source lists for free, which that we then provide to all the circuit courts in the state so they can set up their jury terms. And initially there was some conversation that they didn't think that it impliedly repealed, but then in recent weeks I've had conversations with Kelly, and the gist of it is apparently there is some feeling at DMV that not only could they charge us for this, but there is some belief over there that they would be charging us for jury source lists when we require them, because the money is dedicated highway funds, so they couldn't provide it to them. Provide us jury source lists for free. Well, we actually had this conversation in front of the legislature in 1987 when the requirement that they provide us with free jury source lists was enacted. At that time, there was the feeling in the legislature that there were sufficient undedicated revenues in the Department of Transportation, which is, after all, a reasonably large agency, especially when compared to the courts, that they can cover those kinds of fees without using dedicated revenues. At that time, there was an additional source of revenue that was under ORS 802.260 sub 3 that would have allowed them permissively to charge a fee when they sold records. Apparently, they have an opinion that's going to tell them that they can't charge that money and use it for to provide records because it's from a highway fund resource. Anyway, I'm here to make a record that we still believe that this does not impliedly repeal 10.215, and let you know that apparently there's going to be a conflict between the courts and the DMV on the ability to get jury records for free, something that we think is reasonably important. And we're just surprised that it's the kind of issue that's being raised or that hasn't been raised to the legislature in terms of their budget. And we think this kind of nickel and diming of other agency budgets for fees is something we find unpleasant. And maybe at some point, if the Department of Transportation needs highway fund needs protection from things that it provides for free for other state entities, maybe the things that the courts provide for free to the highway division, like we provide them free access to OGIN online, we provide them their filing fees. I know, Senator Dukes, it is stupid. We think the whole thing is stupid, especially in this instance when we're talking hundreds and maybe a few thousand dollars, but we discovered the proposed shift of funding in the course of analyzing this bill. We thought you should be aware of it, and we actually think it's pretty stupid. But
Mr. Chair, what's stupid is that an officer of the court would sit here and threaten another state agency. And that's what I heard you just do. If they don't give us our records for free, maybe we'll find a way to charge them a fee when it comes around for them. I think I heard you say that all of this started in 87 when the legislature decided something. That was before the Attorney General's decision that said that road fund money couldn't pay for a whole laundry list of things like license plates that we were paying for, customized license plates and things. And so we changed a whole lot. And as far as undedicated money, I think we scraped the last of the moss off that rock in the last special session. Sure. We've taken identification fees and all kinds of things that were undedicated revenue.
Sure.
How much is this? How much
are we talking hundreds, maybe a few thousand dollars. We're not exactly sure. Sure.
And for that, you're taking George, time off of your job to be down here to argue it.
It is. Senator Dukes, we actually don't think this kind of we think that this kind of shift, first of all, should be discussed with the legislature, and not something that would be visited upon us in surprise. Not a lot of money. And what
are
I
you
just
trying to prove that this is constitutional, or are you trying to find undedicated revenues to pay for it?
We think that there are sufficient undedicated revenues in ODOT.
Could you tell us which ones they are? Because we still haven't balanced our budget yet. And if you've got some constitutionally undedicated revenues in a state agency that we can go after, we'd like to know what they are.
Chair George, Senator Dukes, we would have to come up with revenues to pay for this if they charged us. Mm-hmm. They're not revenues that are currently in our budget either.
Have some? Can you identify some revenues
at the time
that are available that we could take?
At the time this was initially passed in 1987, the discussions included discussions about what they used to call the lawnmower fund, and I don't know what they call it now.
We took all of that last special session.
But it is revenues. That was one of the things that was talked about. It was a substantial thought in 87. There were monies, as you know, from the unreclaimed gas tax refunds that were used for a number of miscellaneous administrative things, and the fee that was added at that time for the sale of records was permissive because it wasn't clear that they would need it. But the issue for us, and what I was not threatening DMV, what I was doing was suggesting that if we have an agency that, when directed by the legislature to provide services for free to another part of government, finds that it can't do so for some reason, maybe it would be appropriate to review something that would require the legislature to do the services that are provided to that agency without cost.
Mr. Chair, they were never legally directed to do this sort of stuff, and the direction we gave them was prior to an attorney general's opinion saying that they couldn't do it.
Not to press the point, but Chair George, Senator Dukes, there is actually specific language in ORS 10.215 directing them to provide us with jury source lists without charge.
I'm sorry, I've lost my patience, as anybody in the room can clearly see. I spent a whole lot of years on transportation issues, and my guess would be this is, what, your second or third committee down here testifying on this? And I don't know if the head judge thinks that this is worth spending a lot of taxpayers' dollars down here arguing over for a few hundred dollars. I understand that there's a strong point there, but I also understand that the vast majority of ODOT's money is so constitutionally tied up that we're out there telling people that if they want special license plates, they best pay up front, not even after the fact. And we've wiped out any account that we could find. We wiped out the special transportation fund the other day,
mm-hmm.
senior disabled, although we're going to get back to that, and we wiped out the lawnmower fund. We wiped out any other fund that we thought we could find that wasn't constitutionally dedicated. I think you're riding a horse that isn't moving very fast.
Well, Chair George, Senator Dukes, one of the reasons for my appearing is to make clear that we believe that they're still legally obligated, as the statute stands.
This bill?
Mm-hmm. No, we're suggesting this bill doesn't change it.
Kelly, could we get a clarification what the department intends to do with that section that authorizes that authority?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Tater, Department of Transportation. I have had discussions with Brad because he'd asked the question before, and we talked about it. And I did contact the Attorney General. He had two questions. One was about redisclosure and whether or not they would have to keep records if they redisclosed it, and the other was about whether or not the records could be done for free. And when I called him back, I said, I have good news and bad news. The good news is the redisclosure part will not affect you, because if you're redisclosing a Social Security number as part of your government function, it does not count in the federal law for something you'd have to keep records on. That's not a problem. I said, unfortunately, what we've stumbled on that was not found in the review about a year and a half ago of all the statutes, and we had quite a few bills, as you remember, Mr. Chair, last session to correct statutes, and I told Brad we'll need to work on this in the interim, probably have a concept come back next session to fix this. But the statute 802.260 that talks about providing the records for free and using monies off of other fees collected, we cannot do. Brad and I then talked about whether or not the the quote lawnmower fund, the undedicated funds could be used. That money, as Senator Dukes pointed out, has been totally used up. And there are folks waiting in line that would love to be the next one in there to use that money. And so I said, you know, we're going to need to work this out between our agencies during the interim, but it appears to us that we cannot legally continue to give you that list. We give it annually, one time a year, for free. And I did ask DMV about how much it's going to cost to provide, you know, how much it costs to put that list together each year. And it's between $250 and $300 that they'll need to pay. And, you know, I understand. It is not a comfortable thing to hear that something that has been going along well has to change. But we can't legally do what the statute's asking us to do anymore.
And for the record, we have a disagreement about the legal status of that. And it's one of the reasons we should make you aware, because this is, even though it's small potatoes, and it is small potatoes, it's the kind of controversy that can make government look bad, because it involves getting way too many attorneys involved, for one, but it is a legal issue that continues. They'll get an opinion from their attorney, we'll get an opinion from our attorney. You know, those kinds of things can happen, and we believe that currently they're under the obligation.
We'll have two attorneys from the AG's office.
Senator Moore. Mr. Chairman, it would be worth $250 personally to me to write them a check to get this done and get on something else.
Well, Senator Morris, and I was sitting here thinking,
we'll chip in.
You know, I never asked for my overpaid gas taxes back, you know, and all the things that we use that are on farm. You know, I'm going to ask for my money back now, because you guys are going to fight over my money. Any further questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Okay, I hope not. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else at a public hearing on House Bill 2783A that would like to testify? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2783A, and with the tap of the gavel, we'll be in a work session of House Bill 2783A. No, I don't know if we do, and that's why we need to find out. Are there any questions on the A3s?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, just since it's been a while since we've talked about what the bill really does, one more time. In summary, the Department of Transportation would be collecting the Social Security numbers on the applications for the driver's license. The dash A3s is allowing an individual without a Social Security number to give a written statement to that effect. And in general, the bill is bringing us into compliance with federal requirements so that we can continue receiving about $85 million for the Child Support Enforcement Division and potentially avoid penalties under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. So, and again, the dash A3s, everyone except apparently one agency is in agreement with.
Mm-hmm.
And the fiscal statement, as we've discussed, again, the 3FTE can be decided at a later date. This bill does not provide limitation that can be discussed later when you're working this agency's budget, whether it's for inclusion or not.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Sherman.
Just comments on the discussion between the court and the department. I'm going to follow the chair's direction on this issue. However, I would like to know that the Department of Transportation will follow up with the court system in making some arrangements this summer, because I can see where when you look at the courts, the most we did more damage to the court system in these six special sessions than we did any agency of government. And he wasn't talking about $250. He was talking about $250,000 to $300,000. I think that's...
No.
Like $250?
Uh-huh.
I've already written the check.
Yes, he has a check. Don't push it. I'm going to lose that check.
No, I'll say it.
No, instead of $50.
You help me? Okay.
Yeah, we'll chip in.
And that's what, Senator, that's why I wanted to get on the record that ODOT was in DMV was going to, in fact, be very fair and very conciliatory.
But I do feel that they cannot use federal dollars directly to the ministry. They're directed to be able to allow those dollars to be used by any of us in the future.
We have a suggestion over here that since this is a Ways and Means Committee, that we, with $45 a piece, we can find the ways to find the means to.
Is there in that?
Do we have anyone that would like to move to A3s? Representative Hanson?
I move it.
We have two people that have moved it. That must mean we can do that without objection. So moved. A3s have been adopted.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion to move the bill? Mm-hmm.
You're still smiling about some other things, but I'm trying to get myself under control.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2783 as amended to the full committee of Ways and Means.
Okay, so move, we moved House Bill 2783A as amended to the full Ways and Means with a due pass. Is there any consideration? Yes, Senator Dukes.
I need some help here. I want to be assured that these will end up as FTE somewhere along the line. Now, I'm open. I don't care if they're new FTE. I don't care if they're old FTE that we've been, you know, that we decided to get rid of, that they can now use here. I don't care, you know, where they come from as long as they end up in the budget, because it's just been too many years of, I think ODOT hates this, tend to do my transactions at the office just to see what's going on. They hate it because it's one more person who could be using mail who isn't. That, and I get around to it at the last day to usually do it. But I listen to all kinds of things that people have lots of questions about. They don't do it all the time like they do. And I know that the Kerry Georges of the world are going to be in there arguing with them. It's going to take longer. And every time we've done something, when we required insurance, proof of insurance, oh, heaven forbid, it took a long... The wait lines got really long. We ended up putting in quite a few extra FTE because people would go in and they didn't have it, and then they'd come back. So, and the other thing I want to throw out, just as good of the order, is I noticed that violation of this is a Class A misdemeanor, but at the moment we don't prosecute Class A misdemeanors, so this is a heck of a penalty. But I would like to know, I mean, because I think these are important, I would like to know that they will ultimately end up, and my comfort level at leaving it to the emergency board is nil. So I would like to know that we will deal with that, with this, before the ODOT budget passes out.
Well, Senator, I believe that there will be a delay time because of the question. I mean, I probably will ask the question. And so, you know, between this Gerry George and that Kelly person, I mean, we're causing a lot of disruption here. So I think it's something we must address.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hanson?
Well, I support the concept. Obviously, there's significant federal dollars in line that I don't think we have a lot of options. On the other hand, I think there's a couple things that are facts of life. I'm 59 years old, and I've kind of learned things through the years. Social Security numbers, as much as some people dislike them in terms of moving towards national ID, are a vital part of life and part of records. There's a whole bunch of Gerry Hansons out there. I don't want to get called to jury duty more times than necessary because there's an identity problem. When I do a refinance on my house or buy property, I'm always supplying my Social Security number because there's a great many Gerry Hansons that have numerous liens throughout the state, and somebody needs to be able to sort that out. And so I think there's, although this can be an inconvenience, and it probably enters into our privacy. On the other hand, I don't want to lose my driver's license because another Gary Hansen hasn't made his child support payments. And I think in terms of clarifying and making things a little more simple for a lot of people, this may be information that sadly we have to share now. In terms of the FTEs, another fact of life I've learned over 59 years is that when you go to DMV, you plan for some time. I've been very pleased the last few transactions I've made, how quickly the lines moved, and there was a smile on the face of the employees, and it seems to be working well. But sometimes if you happen to be there on a day when people have a lot of complicated issues to deal with, it's going to take you some time. We will fund as much DMV help as the state of Oregon can afford to in this time. And I don't, this will add the need for 3 FTE over the whole state. And I don't, you know, even if we fund those 3 positions, there will probably be longer lines in the 61 offices that don't get a position. So I think that just kind of a fact of life. I will make this suggestion, though, that I'd be glad to support one of those positions in LeGrand if they'd also establish a pilot project with a scale to verify everybody's weight on the driver's license. But with that aside, I
guess we'll both be no's.
I'll support this.
With that in mind, I think we better call the roll on this.
Senator Morris?
Aye.
Chair George?
Aye. We need a carrier for this. Senator Morris, you were willing to pay. Would you like to be able to?
Sure.
Senator Morris, we need a carrier.
Take my check with it.
Just so everyone who's listening out there, if you would like to make a contribution to the state of Oregon for any department, you can go online and make that contribution. And so we have a mechanism today in order to do that. And so, which is a good thing. With that, I'm going to...
And on the House side?
And the House side.
Okay.
Now, you've got to be careful with Representative Hansen. I gave him my choice bill, and he just barely made it by one vote. Representative Hansen, you're okay? Very good. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2783A, which has been referred to the committee and will be passed. And we will, with a tap of the gavel, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 190.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 190A directs the Board of Maritime Pilots to continue using the Central Hearings Officer Panel to conduct rate proceedings, deletes the requirement that the decisions of the hearings officer be submitted to the board for adoption, and directs the board to adopt rules for conducting the hearings. Probably the most significant piece of this bill, it allows the board to assess the costs to the interested parties subject to the hearing for the hearing costs. The department has been doing this all along. I guess there were some revisions in 1993 that made a technical omission that the board did not have the statutory authority to assess those costs, and that has been brought up to the agency. So this is just seeking to bring the law into line with their current practice. There's a set of amendments. Actually, we'll have you consider conceptual amendments. The dash fours are before you. There was a couple of lines omitted in the drafting.
Given conceptual amendments.
These have been approved, Senator. These conceptual amendments, you have most of it in typed form with just the technical change noted at the bottom. In the drafting of the dash A4s, there was some bold-faced text that needed to be removed from the corrected A and gross. So the conceptual part is technical. And I believe the agency... agency want to come forward and talk about?
My name is Katie Iman. I'm chair of the Board of Maritime Pilots. And on this issue, I'd like to, if I could, ask Dave Fiskum, who represents the Columbia River Pilots Association, and Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators, to join me in testifying about this. Thank you.
A few minutes ago, I was kind of asking one of the lobbyists out because he was so loud in the back.
Why didn't he hear him? Might have heard him here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, it was only a compliment to Senator Carter.
I wonder if you're better believe to hear.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I guess we want to say that we're opposed to the A4 amendments because we want to, one of the main reasons for this bill is because the pilots and steamship operators have worked together with the board to make the hearings on our rates only much more efficient and much better understood. And we'd like to have that handled by the Public Utility Commission and the A4 delete that part of what's been a successful negotiation. So that's why we're opposed to the A4. We'd like to go back to the corrected A and
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'll just make a couple quick comments to buttress what Ms. Iman has said. For the record, Dave Fiskum, representing the Columbia River Pilots. I should say, too, for the record, that I'm here this morning on behalf of Tom Gallagher, who represents the Bar Pilots. Tom is had to be out of town today and authorized me for this limited purpose to speak on his behalf. Ms. Iman has stated the issue accurately, and based on what your staff just said, I could be wrong about this, but it struck me that if the -4s were meant to clarify something, the language on lines 10, 11, and 12 of the -4s appear to make a fairly important policy change from the bill as it arrives on your desk from the Senate Business Committee, and that is it indicates that the hearing shall be conducted by a hearings officer assigned from the hearings officer panel rather than from the Public Utility Commission. And in fact, the policy issue that prompts Senate Bill 190 is the intent, as Ms. Iman has said, to have the rate proceedings conducted by a hearings officer from the Public Utility Commission, given the expertise that commission has in such proceedings. And that idea, which came from the board, enjoys at this instant the support of everybody, I think I could say, of my organization, the bar. Mr. Douglas can speak for the operators. The Board of Maritime Pilots obviously supports it. I would say that we have had discussions over the months with the Public Utility Commission, a representative, Mr. Willis, of whom is here this morning, who would concur with that, the Attorney General. And as well, I think I'm free to say to you that Representative Lane Shetterly has indicated that he is not opposed to this language, and that's important because Representative Shetterly has been the key mover, driver on the hearings officer panel idea, and for this limited purpose, he was very comfortable with the exception as outlined in the original Senate Bill 190. Mr. Chair, I guess that's the basic presentation.
Let us tell you why we are here with us.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, just for clarification, the -A4s, I believe, is correct in testimony. This is a policy decision. The technical piece I was referring to was the hand and gross part at the bottom to say if you're going to move forward with the concept of the A4s, that there was some misdrafting, that there's a couple of lines that need to be eliminated from the bill. The A4s were drafted at the request of the co-chairs, and the policy decision, I think, was disputed or debated in the House committee, or Senate committee, excuse me, on if we're going to have a central hearings panel, do we want to start pulling people back out of the panel or adding people back in? The sunset of the central hearings panel has been removed, so it is now permanent, if anything can be permanent. And the co-chairs were... gave the direction to continue using the central hearings panel. I guess that is a policy decision that has to be made.
And that's what we need to get to, Senator Dukes.
So is LFO making a policy recommendation here on these, the hand and gross at the bottom of the
The Handing Gross piece, Senator Dukes, is not the policy piece. The A4 in total, it's either they can use the Central Hearings Panel or they can use the Public Utility Commission for their rate proceeding. The Handing Gross piece is the technical adjustment, that if you're going to have them use the Central Hearings Panel, there's some additional language that needs to be deleted from the bill. This is, in essence, a policy bill. Do you want them using the Central Hearings Panel or the PUC for their rate proceeding? The dash A4 is changing it from the PUC to the Central Hearings Panel. Was drafted at the request of the co-chairs.
My understanding is that the bill, as it comes to us, uses the PUC.
That is correct.
Yes.
Okay, and I guess I would just make a comment, Mr. Chair, that this is not easy stuff, these hearings, and we used to use the PUC, and it was very successful. And when this kind of hearing is very successful, all the folks represented here save money, and the public gets the hearings through sooner. There are fewer attorneys involved. I think I offend anybody up here with that. It shortens it up. It makes sure that safety works on the Columbia River, which is the only area we're talking about. Well, maybe Coos, I guess. Coos sort of is, still. It just works. And we've been struggling mightily the last few years with the changes that have been made, or they have been struggling mightily with it. And the change back to the PUC makes a lot of sense to me. So we've got a substantive committee that recommended it, the PUC that's willing to take it, the agency and all of their related entities that get to pay for it all in agreement that we should use it. So it sounds like a good deal to me.
Mr. Chair, Rob Douglas representing the steamship operators. This is the first time in my experience where you've had the pilotage grounds and the operators and the board all in agreement. More importantly, you have our attorneys in agreement.
Let's make a motion.
This is not your normal contested case APA hearing. These are very complicated rate hearings. That's what the PUC does best. We, the steamship operators, are spending not $1 million, but well over $500,000 on attorney's fees to go through these contested rate hearings under the current system. We need a simplified system with more expertise, not just someone from the hearings panel. That's not to denigrate the hearings panel and the reason that was set up, but very frankly, we just dead flat cannot afford to enter into these complicated proceedings anymore with ship counts down and everything else. So we would encourage you to send out the bill as it was sent to you.
We have Representative Krieger first and then the Senator Carter.
Sure. I think I kind of agree with Senator Dukes on this. And you got constituent bases of people that are working together and they like the system. They can agree on it. Why do you want to change something that's working? You know, so I'm where you are on this one.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to know the co-chair's thoughts and going back to a hearings panel. Did they talk to you?
They did not talk to me directly about the bill. We have had the conversation about it and their reasoning behind it. And I think with that, we are to the point we will need to get back in consultation with co-chairs, reflecting the viewpoint of the committee. And until this question, I'll get representation.
I was just trying to know. It would appear to me that one of the co-chairs should come before the committee, since it was not done in the substantive committee, and to ask us to do this level of policy work down here. Of course, it's not unheard of for us to do it. But at the same time, it would just appear to me, while we're at it, we could work with, because I'm in agreement with the request. If something ain't broke, don't worry about trying to fix it, because it messes up even worse. But it makes sense to me in a day when we're cutting everybody's budgets, and they're saying it would be less expensive for them to go to an agency that is already in place and whose sole responsibility, not sole responsibility, whose responsibility is to set rates. I just don't understand why we want to bring outside costs into the equation when in reality there was an agency that does it best. And so I would question that as well, and I would love to hear from one of the co-chairs in terms of this issue.
Let me ask this question. It appears to me that what happened, we weren't broke, then we were broke, and now we're trying to go back to where we were before, if I understand what you guys are doing with the bill.
Yes. And I want to make it clear that on behalf of the board, Chair, that we're not opposed to using, in fact, we support using the hearings panel for all non-rate hearing proceedings, if a licensing matter or something else, anything else that would be a contested case. We think the hearings panel is great. It's a very limited situation where we'd be using the PUC. It's only for rates. And in terms of the floodgates that the co-chairs may be concerned about, well, if there's an exception here, there might be an exception for other places. We did a look at to see what other agencies actually set rates, and we think we're, except for the PUC, the only one that actually set rates like this. So this is a limited exception. It wouldn't be used as a model to justify other exceptions for agencies to get out of the hearings panel, and that's why Representative Shetterly supported it.
Mr. Chair, I'll just close with 10 seconds worth of saying that the limited exception, narrow exception thing here, that's why this bill's before you, as opposed to this being an amendment to a general hearings officer panel bill. That was expressly at the request of those key legislators involved in the hearings officer panel to connote the fact that it was a very narrow exception that was being granted should you pass this bill. Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a big supporter of the hearings panel, but I think there's a real difference between most of their work, which is usually involved in compliance cases,
right,
and a rate setting. And I can certainly understand the wisdom of keeping rate settings with people that primarily do that type of work, and it's pretty complicated. The other real question too is in terms of the role of this committee, whether this is a substantive policy issue or a ways and means issue, and I'm kind of based on the pretty direct guidelines that we've got in terms of not going into issues of substantive policy matters, that this seems to be the A4s would be sort of a glaring exception to that, that I think I'd want to hear an in-depth explanation from the co-chairs in terms of why in this one particular area we are being charged with making this level of policy.
Senator Carter. Okay.
I was just going to ask Senator Dukes if she thought this was a jobs program for lawyers.
The way it currently is, yeah. Okay. The way it's currently configured.
All right.
You
what
bet.
We're going to do right now? We'll stand at ease for a few minutes.
Thank you.